The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. So welcome to Secure in Mind, a podcast where we explore technology, cybersecurity, innovation, artificial intelligence, and we even explore things like smart cities. And that's why I've brought on a very special guest who I met in South Africa at a conference. He was one of the keynote speakers. And I was so enthralled by the discussion and his background and what he'd achieved that I couldn't wait to get him on the podcast. And so without any further ado, here's Jonathan Reichenthal. Jonathan, welcome.
Well, thanks very much. Great to chat with you this morning.
You too. And apologies to the listeners out there. We will have cut about 20 minutes worth of fiddling around with the audio, and fingers crossed we've got it to a point where it's almost presentable. So let's see after the recording. So Jonathan, we met at the Invest South Africa Summit in Johannesburg, which was focused on sort of injecting investment and interest in developing the city and the broader and the country as well. Was that right?
That's right. And it was specifically the relationship between Italy and South Africa.
Gotcha. And your speech, I remember you were talking about some of the things that you'd done with Palo Alto, which we'll get into it later in this discussion, but I can't recall if there were any specific focus that you had or any discussions that you had with the Johannesburg the council or with the city. Was that also part of it?
Yeah. My talk was about, you know, kind of explaining some of the magic of Silicon Valley and both what can be imitated around the world, but also what is difficult to imitate. So that was sort of the thesis there. And then I did get a chance to speak with the mayor of Johannesburg and then the governor of the province of Gauteng, which is where Johannesburg is. So I did have some very nice conversations with, you know, some of their elected leadership. And then during the different networking events and meals, I had a great opportunity to network with a whole range of entrepreneurs and leaders across the South African ecosystem. Yeah. So just a really wonderful trip and an important one too. You know, here in particularly in the United States, we don't have a good sense of Africa and its issues and its importance in the future. I am somebody now who, when I'm giving some of my more kind of big picture talks, am encouraging leaders and government officials to begin to pay attention to Africa, not only as a place where, you know, a lot of the future will belong, but to look at things like, for example, the changing economics and the opening of new markets. And so, you know, we ignore Africa at our peril. You know, I just want to get that out there. This is an important topic for everybody to begin to explore and actually take action. I mean, we're late. And you know, Europe is probably doing more. Certainly China, it's probably not lost on anyone the extent to which China is investing in Africa, seeing it as the future and seeing it as a market. And, you know, not without its controversy, of course, but certainly they recognize it as an important frontier for the 21st century.
Yeah. And I'd really just remembering some of the themes that were discussed during the conference. I remember the emphasis on Africa as a unit, and that was quite interesting. And because of course you've got some of the larger economies. I mean, case in point, the South African economy dwarfs some of the other economies throughout the country. But the emphasis on banding together and presenting an African technology suite, and I liked that, and I think that's a really good maneuver.
Yeah.
But, you know, and also one of the primary themes was we need more investment money. And obviously that's paramount. And if you're getting that investment money from one source, and that's going to sway some of your support.
I was particularly taken by the keynote by the mayor of Johannesburg. You know, he didn't mix words. I mean, he was very direct on a couple of things.
He was a very colorful figure, wasn't he? Really, really fun guy.
He was, but you know, he's in a tough environment. I mean, you know, Johannesburg and South Africa in general is undergoing tremendous change. There's significant problems with unemployment and attracting investment. But his big point was South Africa is the most successful economy and biggest economy on the continent of Africa.
Yeah.
If South Africa fails, Africa fails. If Africa fails, there will be mass migration into Europe, and Europe will be challenged.
Yeah.
If Europe is challenged, then America is challenged. So he painted this very big.
He did it really well, didn't he? Yeah.
He did. Yeah. Yeah. So that impacted me a lot. That whole sort of picture he painted of why it's in everyone's interest to be invested in the future success of Africa.
Yeah.
On so many different levels. I mean, look, it's time for Africa to emerge. And again, I think our image of failed states is wrong too. There's just plenty of examples of very successful emerging economies in Africa. You know, if you look out 20 to 50 years, which I often do in some of my work, all the fastest growing economies in the world are all there. So a very, very important place for us to understand and be engaged in.
Absolutely. So you mentioned your work, and we'll get to that. But
sure.
You know, we aim on this podcast to, I guess, you know, get an understanding of what makes the person tick behind the policy or the innovation or the want to create a more secure world. So we'll skip back to your background and I guess the path that took you to where you are now. What happened in your life?
I know. Wow. I'm constantly reminded that life is not a straight line. You know, that's one of my big takeaways from this human experience we each have. I was actually born in Ireland. I'm you know, of Irish descent, although my family name is Eastern European, comes from my father, of course. And, you know, he traveled from Eastern Europe, found himself in Ireland. And I often joke that I just continued the westward journey and ended up here in California.
Hey,
in
the west
of the United States.
It's not a bad location to end up, to be honest.
Yeah, but if my children continue the westward journey, they'll head to China and Russia and finally end up where we started. You know, so we will have done the trip around the world over a couple of generations.
Oh, beauty. No,
I had a wonderful childhood, and you know, Ireland was an amazing place to grow up, and you know, just such great fun memories. I had a chance as a young adult then to come to the United States with a green card, and you know, I went after really for adventure. You know, I don't know that I had a big plan, but like so many people around the world, you know, I grew up on a, you know, served up American culture through television and music and art and you know, so America had a kind of a unique place in my imagination. And so back in the early 90s, I decided, hey, let's give this a shot. Let's see what I can do with this. And came to Florida. And, you know, it's interesting. I left Ireland, not famous for its climate, of course, but not as bad as people think. You know, cloudy, but it doesn't rain every day, but certainly not a sunshine climate. And, you know, I jumped on that flight, you know, landed in Miami Beach, and, you know,
how old were you?
Early to mid-20s.
Okay.
Already. So yeah, I'd already had a little bit of a career in Ireland, and I also got my first engineering degree over there. I continued to study in the U.S. Actually, I got three more degrees in the U.S. educational system, another undergraduate, a master's, and then I finally got a PhD, earned a PhD as my terminal degree back in 2006.
And what were they? Because that'll give, I guess, as a side note for listeners who are pursuing their academic path, maybe that will give a good idea of how, you know, these pieces fit together, or maybe it's completely haphazard.
No, well, for some of us it is. That's, you know, part of kind of discovering who you are.
Of life. Yep.
What you love. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that we're forced. In many educational systems, we have to make a choice, you know, what courses to pursue at the ripe old age of 17 and a half or 18, and we really don't have a clue.
No,
and,
so you have no idea who the hell you are.
Yeah, basically, that's right. And so, you know, if I went back to being 17 again and making those choices, possibly would have taken a slightly different turn. But I was already a tech guy. You know, I had followed in my brother's footsteps. He was the guy who brought a computer home. When we were kids, and you know, I watched them program, and I learned to program that way. And so I knew technology was going to be a big part of my future. I was okay. I was like in a decent at it. So it was interesting to me. And so my first degree was actually industrial engineering, sort of a kind of a broad kind of a management science topic with some engineering and some, you know, business baked in there. And of course, a series of basic technology courses. When I came to the US, I really wanted to experience the third level education system here. And so I got another undergraduate in computer information systems. Okay. And then my graduate degree, my first master's was in management information systems. And finally, my PhD was in pure information systems. And, you know, in a way, it sounds like, wow, you just kind of did more of the same. But, you know, as you go through the different levels of education, you get deeper and deeper. And when you get to a PhD, you are learning a more narrow amount of knowledge, but much, much, much deeper, right? There's not like a lot of reasons to pursue a PhD. A master's will serve you well in life. You know, the data shows that, you know, you make a big leap in income when you have an undergraduate degree. You make another nice leap in income when you have a master's, but you don't really make another leap in income when you earn a PhD.
Yeah.
So that's not a...
But you gain a lot of gray hairs and stress.
You do. And you have an amazing learning experience. And I mean, I always say that, well, first of all, it's not for everyone, but, you know, those 3 or 4 years of intense study for doing the prerequisite courses and then the writing the actual dissertation, it was hard work. It was like an intense daily workout, physical workout, but for your brain.
Yeah.
And, you know, all through those years, there are many days when you hate it. But when you are finished, that is one heck of a gratifying feeling. And it served me well. I mean, I've had a lot of advantages due to that. You know, because my passion is teaching and education, having a PhD has opened many, many doors and allows me to teach quite often now. And, you know, I'll tell you what the dean said of the program when my cohort group started the PhD. He said, you know, a PhD will open doors for you. It'll get you to the table. But the minute you open your mouth, all bets are off. You know, it only gets you so far. You are then in control at the point at which, you know, you are giving your contributions. But it does open doors. It does make it easier for you to get an audience with certain people or to be considered for certain activities. You know, but certainly a master's degree is probably perfect for most people trying to grow their career, earn additional income, do more sophisticated work.
Okay. So you've come to the States. You've embarked on another several degrees. Moving into, I guess, when you kicked off your career prior to, and we'll focus on Palo Alto because it's a great example of a lot of the kind of innovations work that you did prior, all put in one area, one sort of playground for you to have fun in. What did you do then? You went from memory PricewaterhouseCoopers, weren't you, for a while?
Yeah. My first job in the States was, actually, they were at the time, they were Coopers and Lybrand.
Yeah.
They were one of the big eight. And then there was a ton of mergers, and, you know, finally it was the big four. I think it's still the big four today. And one of them, you know, Coopers and Lybrand merged with Pricewaterhouse, became PricewaterhouseCoopers. And I stayed there for about 14 years, actually. But when you work for a global company with about 150,000 people, revenue closing in on about $30 billion, you can have multiple careers.
Yeah.
You know, it's like working for a city or, you know, the customers of the business is enough work without having to deal with the customers of the business. You know,
I mean,
the same customers inside the business. And so I had multiple old tech jobs. You know, I managed a very large help desk team. I ran a software engineering group. And then, you know, the job that I had in the last few years of my time at PwC, I think were the most defining years in terms of what I did next. Was I was the head of technology innovation for the firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say to people that, and recollecting that, that was a job where when I got paid every 2 weeks, it was like a bonus. It was like I was doing my hobby and getting paid well for it. And I was like, that's a great job. That's what I want to do.
That's kind of the aim, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah. No, you know, to this day, that's what I preach and I try to live that. There's a great saying, you know, find your song and sing it every day. And you know, when I coach people, which I do quite often, I have a group of coaches and, you know, I'm saying to them, you got to do what you love. You got to be happy. far as we know, you get, you know, only a few trips around the sun. So if that's the case, make sure what you're doing every day is what gets you excited and where you can best make contributions. Hard for people, really, really hard for people. Not in any way suggesting this is trivial or simple. You know, people have all sorts of obligations and constraints, but, you know, I really do believe that that is a worthy goal. When you find that thing or get close to it, you will find happiness and you will find more meaning in your life, and you'll be a better person because you'll be happier with your family and with your friends and your colleagues. I did that for several years. And then back in 2008, the firm PwC was going through some change, as was most of the global economy. And I used that opportunity. That seemed like the perfect time after about 14 years to sort of move to my next opportunity. And I wanted to grow my influence and rise even further up in the IT stack. So I was lucky enough to get an opportunity with O'Reilly Media over in California, working for Tim O'Reilly's organization.
Okay.
He's often called the Oracle of Silicon Valley, a big thinker, very well respected guy. And he had built this very successful tech/media company. You'll recall, for example, his business was the leaders of the Web 2.0 movement during the 2000s. And
he's from Ireland as well, isn't he?
He's Irish, as was his partner in the business, Dale Daugherty, too, who went on to create the Maker movement and Maker Faire. They recently broke that off as an independent company. Yeah, so that was a blast. Tim O'Reilly had a lot of success, moved his company from the East Coast, from the Massachusetts area, to the West Coast and into the apple orchards of Sebastopol up in the Santa Rosa area of Northern California. So it really was out there. I mean, it's a beautiful place surrounded by vineyards and apple orchards, but it's not the big city. At my core, I'm a city guy, which I've learned now the last few years for sure, having focused my career on cities. And so after a few years there, I got a phone call from a headhunter and they said, hey, would you consider being the CIO of a city? And I was like, wow, I never thought about that. And yeah, whenever you're offered an opportunity, don't be closed-minded. Listen, just be open-minded, listen to the opportunity. Even if you don't think you're qualified or you think it's a complete detour from your career, it's fascinating what opportunities and interesting, compelling suggestion might open up for you. And so I could have said, no, there's no way I'm working for government, bureaucratic, slow, too many regulations. But instead, I kept an open mind and I met with the city manager and some of the team. And it was Palo Alto, which was the birthplace of Silicon Valley. But, well, if I'm going to do government, that's probably the place to do it.
Yeah. It's a nice transition.
It is. And what I think really attracted me was the city manager, Jim Keane, who just retired after over 30 years in public service. He had a real disposition for innovation and urban innovation and wanted me to see what was possible and wanted to work with me. And together, over 7 years, I think we definitely pushed the envelope of what was possible for a sort of small to medium-sized Californian city. And we created tension and pushed up against the boundaries of what people were comfortable with. And in many ways, I think that's the definition of innovation. And it was a great run. So that was an amazing 7 years. I think we're probably going to talk more about that in a moment, right?
Yeah, that's right where we're leading to now. So with the sort of foundation laid, jump into what you did in Palo Alto. So smart cities, we hear the terminology a lot. What does it mean to be a smart city? I guess would be good to start with, and some examples of concrete innovations that you implemented during your time. Those would be sort of that'd be the initial part. And then I'd like to sort of discuss, you referred to before about the slight hesitation initially about potentially working in public sector.
Yeah.
I'm certainly interested to see how easy it is to get the support both at the state level, at the federal level, to actually implement and toy around and experiment with some of these innovations. Because some of them will be pushing the envelope so much that you might be upsetting the apple cart and you won't be able to get anything approved or you won't be able to get the backing from different departments. So we'll cover that. First of all, what is a smart city? What did you do? Some examples from Palo Alto.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for setting all that up. All good stuff. And by the way, the level of interest in this topic is huge. It's not an American thing or European. I see it in almost every corner of the world. And in many ways, it's just getting started. Let me establish some baselines, and it might be already familiar to a lot of your listeners. The future belongs to cities. Up until 2008, the majority of humans lived in a rural setting. After 2008, approximately, we became a majority urban planet, and that's accelerating. So, you know, we have to recognize that the world has changed just in the last 10 or 12 years. We are now an urban planet, and by the end of the 21st century, most humans are living in a city context. That's the first time.
Mm.
And you know, our cities were built for that scale. And you know, when you start to have millions of people move into cities that you know are not ready, when you start to create what are called mega cities, cities of 25 million, 30, 40 million people now.
I used to live in Bangladesh. That's a in Dhaka. That's a major. That's a mega city.
Yeah. No. You got it. And you start to see significant pressure on almost every aspect of society. You know, you think about something just like infrastructure.
Yeah.
But look, this doesn't have to be complicated for people to understand it. Mm. If you sit in traffic, you know, in a morning commute or coming home in the evening from the office, and you have to go 10 miles and it takes you an hour or whatever, you know it's broken.
Yeah.
You know, our car-driven roadway systems in our cities and in our countries has largely failed us on multiple levels.
Mm.
It served us in some respects, but you know, as we enter the sort of second quarter of the 21st century, we're in real trouble. You know, we've created urban sprawl and it's damaging the climate. It's making lots of places where people don't want to live. Lots of congestion, mental health issues. It is a significant problem now. But that's just one dimension. So let's get back to your question. What is a smart city? You know, that's a good branding term. It doesn't have to be the only way we describe the space. But what we're really talking about is a smart city is the response to these emerging needs.
Mm.
Right. It's how does a city respond to the needs of the 21st century?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that question is it's going to be multidimensional, but a big part of it is going to involve technology,
mm-hmm.
you know, massive part of it. We're not going to be able to solve, you know, 21st century problems with 20th century solutions and tools. And you know that quote. I've been saying that for a couple of years. And we need new ways of delivering government services. We need new ways of managing things like transportation. Energy, you know, clean, safe, environmentally friendly, non-carbon energy. You know, how do we manage things like public safety, housing, green space, you know, climate change? This is a big topic, and it represents, by the way, there's urgency here, but it also represents an economic opportunity. You know, the pitch I make to a lot of tech conferences is twofold in the smart city space. One is the work to be done in our cities is important work, and it's socially positive. So if you do it, you're actually doing meaningful work every day. You're actually making a difference in the world. That's point number one. Point number two is you can do socially important work and make money. You can actually build a great business. So, you know, I think of it as sort of a win-win. Now, you can choose to do other stuff. You can have a startup in the social media space, or you can do another shopping app or something. But there's a vast sort of white space of opportunity for entrepreneurs and new talent to enter the urban innovation space. So that to me, you know, we have to make our cities function to support the needs of the 21st century and beyond. And that to me is what defines this notion of smart cities.
Okay. So now some concrete examples. So if we're looking, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20, and then 50 years ahead, lay the groundwork and sort of talk about what's theoretically plausible and actually what's been practically implemented.
Well, big differences, of course, in a wide time span there. Sort of some near term, cities have to sort of migrate from analog to digital. That's to me one of the most urgent things. You know, there's still too much paperwork. There's still too much inefficiency. That inefficiency creates a bad user experience, or what we like to call now a GX, a government experience, a bad government experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's expensive and it's error prone. There's more things too. So we got to get core processes of cities online, so you can deal with government on your smartphone and tablet with your watch, you know, through a traditional laptop.
Rather than sitting in a queue for 3 hours with more and more people entering into the urban theater. Yeah.
Which, regretfully, is still characteristic of most cities.
Yeah.
So you might say, well, we must be there. You know, we paying parking tickets or requesting a birth certificate or, you know, these must be already online. And certain countries, certain cities, this is the case, but largely that's not the case.
Yeah.
So I can't overstate the need for urban digitization. I think that's probably a big one. And there's lots of great examples of apps that cities use for all sorts of applications. There's some really great work being done by federal and local services to improve the actual user experience or the government experience. So it's easy.
Yeah.
Now you look at a website for requesting healthcare or a government healthcare or maybe a passport in certain countries. That's really complicated.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that way. Even in the US, when you're requesting, for example, to initiate a new permit, you know, many people are scared off because there's too many questions and the click-through pages are just too hard. So they end up going to a physical place. And then there's just tons of services that are not being offered that way.
Yeah.
So that's a big piece. That's worth likely trillions of dollars over a few decades.
Yeah.
So excellent work there. And so at the city of Palo Alto, you know, in 7 years I was there, we implemented over 60 different digital services covering everything from, you know, permit requests to reporting a crime, to paying a parking ticket, knowing where to recycle materials, reporting issues like abandoned bicycles or graffiti, a app or an application for booking theater tickets at the government, you know, at the city theaters. So we had a whole range of services that we converted from what used to be old, slow, problematic analog services to digital services.
Okay.
So you've got sort of that. Now, I could talk about other, you know, there's lots of interesting things within that space alone. For example, how do you operate a more efficient 911 service utilizing, you know, the best of digital technology?
Mm-hmm.
And many governments are making the migration to improve 911 systems, emergency service systems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you, for example, if a city runs an ambulance service like Palo Alto did, how do you do some early diagnostics on a patient as they're traveling from their source destination to the hospital?
Yeah.
And then transmit that data from the ambulance to the doctors and nurses that are waiting for the patient.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to have some digital, you got to have some hardware for that. You got to have some good communications and you got some good software. So there's lots of room in cities, including Palo Alto, where we're filling in with contemporary technology, some gaps that wasn't possible before, which is creating a better experience. You know, in this case, even helping people have a better outcome to their medical emergencies.
Yep.
As we go out a few years, there's a couple of things which jump out at me. The big one is the emergence of self-driving vehicles. I will go on record and say the introduction of self-driving vehicles may be the most important technology of the first 50 years of the 21st century. There are so many consequences to this shift, ranging from impacts to jobs. The biggest employer in the United States of men in a single occupation is driving, whether it's driving trucks or any type of vehicle. And the number is anywhere from 4 to 7 million people. They will be impacted, no doubt. But self-driving cars means we can maybe even design our cities differently. You don't have to have traffic signals in a self-driving world. You don't even have to have lanes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, computer-driven automobiles don't require the things that were built for human drivers.
Yeah.
We'll possibly see the reduction in accidents. I mean, that's a big hope. And thus, you'll see impacts, for example, to the insurance industry, who make a lot of money from high premiums because humans are really bad at driving.
Yeah.
What happens when there are less accidents? You know, the business model for insurance companies have to shift. So big changes as a consequence of that. So that's in the next few decades. That's not next year.
Yeah.
Anyone who says self-driving cars will be here by 2020 or 2021, 22, too optimistic. This is a multi-decade shift, in my view.
But a city like Palo Alto is certainly gearing up and laying the foundation to actually develop both highway systems or potentially a pipeline for that.
Well, the way we look at it is we will be quick to respond to any needs. So you've got the needs, for example, of entrepreneurs. And, you know, on a given day, you certainly might see a Google, you know, Waymo self-driving vehicle driving around Palo Alto. And then we might get approached by other self-driving startups who want to experiment. So we're going to be open to that. A lot of the change is going to be driven at the federal level.
Yeah.
And this will be the case in many countries because you can't really do it city by city. It doesn't make any sense because people drive between cities. You know, cars have to go between areas. So you've got to do it on a national basis, and then you got to coordinate with states and then with cities.
Yeah, and that certainly drives into one of the next points that I wanted to ask you, which was that interconnection between, say, local, city, state, federal government. I know that there's a Connecting and Security in Communities document for federal agencies working together. And it's quite, you know, it's quite a complicated thing, right? Because you've got a bunch of different departments working crossways in a matrix type of scenario. I think I sent you some notes before the recording, but if you've got 20 different departments and then little the state departments and then the city councils, it has to be mandated at a federal level. But putting all those Lego blocks together is bloody tough.
Well, I couldn't say that better than you. Your words are correct. It's really tough. Yeah. But that shouldn't stop us. I mean, this is work we have to do. Look, coordinating things even within a single city is hard.
Yeah.
You know, I'll go on record to say that. And nobody would dispute that. You know, in a city, so here's a difference. People ask me a lot about how do I compare public service versus my experience in the private sector.
Yeah.
And this is, there's a lot of similarity, but there's a heck of a lot of difference. And one of the dimensions is how they're organized. And so in a private setting, in a private business, normally you have a leader who is driving a singular purpose. You have a set of products and services, and the idea is to ship those products successfully, to build great products and have the marketplace respond. And everybody is really rallying around that core driver.
Yeah.
In public service, and particularly in cities, they are made up of multiple businesses. In many cases, tens, if not hundreds, of different businesses. I mean, there's very little similarity between the fire service, and a library service, right?
Yeah.
They serve people, of course, but the way they operate, their function and their motivations and how they, get measured is different. So in a city context, you're literally running multiple businesses that don't have to work together, don't have overlap. So when you want to do things like have core systems and things, you have to get people who have very different incentives around a table to agree on the same path. And that's really, really hard. Now, Palo Alto is a small city. So we were able to do things that a large city like New York or Barcelona or city, Bangalore in India has a lot of difficulty doing, because getting all the right people to agree on a strategy is remarkably hard.
Yeah.
So then you get regional, which gets harder. You get state, and then you get, federal, and it gets quite complicated. One of the areas where we see some progress in the Silicon Valley region is around transportation. I mean, there's everything from Uber to trains to metro, taxis, bicycle networks, and things like that. We're going to see improvements when we can have some coordination between all these things. For example, having a single transport card that allows you to hop on and hop off different types of mobile modalities. And everyone has to agree on that. And you have to have systems that interconnect. So there is kind of urgency there. People are generally on the same page, and we're seeing some good progress. But that's an early indicator of the kinds of things we're going to have to do when it comes to, for example, supporting self-driving cars and flying cars and broad responses to climate change. Because if Palo Alto is the only one of 40 cities in Silicon Valley that go solar, we might as well not have done it. We've got to do these things on a regional and national basis.
Well, that's a topic for another podcast altogether.
Sure.
The focus of this podcast, I would love to get into a discussion about that, but we'll press on to the privacy and security aspect of a smart city. So I guess for many listeners who do listen to this podcast, security and privacy are a big part of what they do. An interconnected city, what kind of provisions are made, and also the privacy implications of being so connected. I was reading the other day something about San Diego, a range of street lamps that they'd set up, which are intelligent street lamps, which do a range of really cool things. Like, for example, they've got video, they've got audio, microphone capabilities, and the video can say, look for car park, where as soon as a car leaves the street, then a user with an application will get a ping, or we'll see that there's a car spot available. And that means that they're not driving around emitting more than they need to. And also they're not holding up traffic because they can duck into that car park. Now, that's one of the many positive aspects. One of the many negative aspects would be that you have a recording device everywhere in the city. And so obviously, and I think for fairly good reason, privacy advocates are saying, well, that's a big security risk, especially, and a privacy breach, especially if there aren't security provisions protecting that data. So during your time in Palo Alto, maybe bring up a case study or two which either mimics that or is similar to that, or at least your views on the security and privacy aspect.
Yeah, no, I'm actually, I like this topic a lot. I like cybersecurity a lot. It's a big topic, complicated one. It's interesting in every domain, but it's particularly interesting in a city context. Sadly, cybersecurity has not been, cybersecurity and privacy, I'm sorry, I'm kind of putting it in the same bucket, but I know they're different. Mm. But the broad sort of security space hasn't always got the priority it requires. And in an increasingly sort of software-driven, data-driven world, we quickly have to make it one of the top priorities. I was warmed a little bit to see that in 2018 survey of city, state, and federal priorities in the United States, cybersecurity was number one. For the first time in all three categories. That's great. Now, whether we're acting on it and the extent we're investing in it is obviously another question, but the fact that we're making it a priority is really heartwarming. It's great. There are, you gave an example of some issues potentially in San Diego. I mean, there are many, many examples we can show where cities have been hacked. Atlanta went through a very significant ransomware challenge a few months ago that brought the city to its knees for several days. So, you know, it's a serious topic. In Palo Alto, one of the first things I did when I joined as their first cabinet-level CIO, or department-level CIO, I should say, sorry, it was to make cybersecurity a priority and to hire the first information security manager for the city. And that was my first big action. I had to get approval from the council. They approved it. I found a great guy. And he wrote up, working with me, we wrote up a cybersecurity strategy for the city. And then we started to invest. And we actually, over 7 years, invested several million dollars. The work is never done, as you know. And when we move forward with protection, the bad guys find a way around it. And we have to move forward again. And it's just this ongoing battle. And so, you know, some of it was basic, you know, just making sure that we had great antivirus and anti-malware software installed across our infrastructure, upgrading and replacing our firewalls, segmenting our network as appropriate. So we did a lot of the important blocking and tackling, but we also educated our people. We made cybersecurity training a priority. In the realm of privacy, this got increasingly important over the years I was there. And as we began to think about things like deploying sensors in our around the cityscape, the questions of privacy and what we were collecting and how we were storing it all started to come up. And so much so, I mean, we didn't do a lot of work in that area because we did want to make sure we had policy in place. And one of our council members was particularly passionate about this space and really championed privacy policy for what we were terming surveillance technology. Part of it was driven by a phenomenon in the US of police officers getting putting cameras on their uniforms to that film all events as they happen. So once you start doing that, you're collecting hundreds and thousands of hours of footage of people. Mm. And the questions then become, how is that being protected for people that are innocent? What about protecting children and all that kind of thing? So we made privacy a real priority in Palo Alto. I was very, very proud of that. I was very happy to support our council around that. It did slow things down, and that was probably appropriate. But there is a tension between, you know, cybersecurity, privacy, and innovation. They all, you know, they're knocking their heads. Because in innovation, you want to move forward quickly. You want to take risks.
Yeah.
You want to try things that haven't been tried before. And all of those are things that sort of bleed into, well, if it's intensely digital driven, it's probably collecting data.
Yeah.
It's collecting data. How has the data been stored? Who has access to it? How long is it stored for? You know, how will it be used?
You can see the scale of the complexity in moving into a smart city construct. Because if Palo Alto, which you would, you know, arguably one of the more advanced, more receptive to making a conversion into a full smart city type of construct, has difficulties and bangs its head against the wall when you have this this friction between the innovation and also the necessity of building in very properly vetted, properly constructed legislation around risk, security, privacy, etc. How are other cities going to fare when they're up against that challenge? But I'll put a caveat to that. I think we're always going to be faced with the friction between the innovation guys and the devs who just want to roll things out, and then the security and risk guys who are saying, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. Hold on, hold your horses there. So I don't know, maybe I'm kind of badly answering my own question, but I think it's a real tough one. And yeah, if I can articulate the question better, if Palo Alto, how did you find it, at least from a receptiveness perspective and then from an action perspective, did even though there was friction, there was still support and a general movement and push forward and successes?
Yeah, I think that's right. People say to me, well, Palo Alto was successful with a lot of urban innovation because it's a tech community and you're surrounded by tech companies and everybody's sort of tech savvy. And my answer to that is there's a little bit of that, but generally I had to make the case and work hard to have anything happen.
Mm.
And this is going to be the case in every community. You're not going to get a easy pass on any one of these areas that you're where you're pushing the envelope or making people feel uncomfortable about how you're implementing a new solution.
Yeah, because you're kind of, you know, so with some people who may not be as au fait with the innovations that are happening around the world, they'll just know you as the crazy guy who's talking about flying cars and the Jetsons.
So, that's right. Yeah. You know, I think one of the skills of leaders today, one of the important qualities is, first of all, the ability to communicate complicated ideas to decision makers, but also to be relatively strong in your persistence. I say relatively because at some point you just stop, you know, it gets annoying or it's, you know, you're not making progress. But the first time someone says no to you is probably not the time to stop. You know, if you go in front of a council and you're saying, hey, we want to put up an air quality sensor network around our city. And, you know, the reaction is no way because you're going to collect private information and we don't know how it'll be stored. It might be stolen. These are good and important concerns, but you need to be able to address those concerns. And maybe you say, okay, I didn't win today, but I'm going to come back with more evidence to suggest this is how we're going to ensure that we protect the public's data and the public's information. And so you come back again, you try again. And that's what I did. I mean, nothing was easy in Palo Alto. And every, I think, city CIO will probably agree that that's their world. It is hard. I think, though, there is a new generation of elected officials. I mean, we see that now in the field of people running for president in the United States. You know, you're starting to see a group of people who are, you know, what we call internet natives, people born with technology. People who understand the value and importance that technology brings to the table. And so even in Palo Alto, we started to see a new generation of elected officials come in during my time who you could have a deeper conversation about, you know, the value of, you know, high-speed connectivity or things like sensor networks, why the Internet of Things in a city context makes a lot of sense. Things like supporting terrestrial delivery drones or even, you know, flying drones. And so the debate was better, probably is the right way to characterize it.
Yeah.
Didn't always get the answer I wanted. That's completely fine. Often we did. But the debate was higher quality, and that's important. It means we're talking about the right things.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I think we're sort of heading towards the end, but that's been a really good snapshot, I guess, of some of your work in Palo Alto, some of the complexities that you've faced and that I guess every city will face as we all hurtle towards this interconnected, automated, smart world of ours before we burn up in a flame of climate change, hopefully not. And I guess to sort of more of a wrap up now, what are you doing nowadays? Because I know that you've, after 7 great years, you mentioned that you've left Palo Alto. So I guess this is a bit of a time to sort of plug some of what you're doing. If there's consulting engagements, where can people find you online? Where are you teaching? That type of thing.
Yeah, thank you. That's very kind of you to give me that opportunity. I've been working, you know, solidly for 30 years, little break with increasing responsibility. And when I finally, about a year ago, started the thinking process of what am I going to do next? How can I have greater impact in the world? How can I do important things that have value and that has meaning? I had to recognize that I'd been sort of driving to the office for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And as we approached the end of 2018, I had a number of different options I was considering, including a very nice offer from a very large software company. And, you know, over the holidays, I sort of said, you know what, this is a great moment for me not to move from one complicated sort of corporate environment to another, you know, complicated corporate environment, but actually to spread my wings a little bit, create some freedom in my life, to go after the projects that I'm passionate about and the work I'm really passionate about. And it's really all about positive social change, all in the context of emerging technology, emerging, you know, best practices in management and business. So from about January of this year, just a few months, I've been running my own little business, delivering advice and education to a range of public and private organizations. Mm-hmm. So far, so good. It's early, though, but I'm loving it. And there's a nice supply of requests and engagements for me to deliver. So I'm going to sort of figure out, you know, the bigger plan as the year progresses. But I definitely want to make sure that I'm doing the work that I love and it's having a real impact. So, yeah, the pitch is, if I can help your organization navigate through the complexities of the future, I'm probably the right guy to make a call to or reach out to me. And if I'm not, I have a terrific Silicon Valley and global network that I can connect you to. So I'd be thrilled to have that conversation. I'm pretty easy to find. You know, LinkedIn is probably the best way. LinkedIn, or I'm also quite active on Twitter, at Reichenthal, at R-E-I-C-H-E-N-T-A-L. And so I'd welcome the conversation. And we can talk about everything from the future cities to the fourth industrial revolution to the emergence of blockchain technology and quantum computing and the future of work. I mean, we have, as societies and as a planet, we have some big topics that we have to address, and we have to adopt completely new approaches and strategies to continue to be successful. Mm. I'm an optimist. So even though you can look out and say, hey, climate change is that's a big ugly thing out there, I continue to be optimistic. And I think bringing the right people and creativity and energy to the table, we've shown in the past we can make change. And I still think we have the chance to own the future and have a great future.
Well, that sounds like a very nice note to end on. And fingers crossed, you know, some of the listeners or even some people who I know may be able to bring you over to Europe for some engagements. And then you can sort of reverse that journey, you know, from Ireland to the United States, but then back for a couple of times over in Europe. Look, Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. It's been really interesting to hear, I guess, the pathway toward a smart city career that you've had and also some of the work and some of the complexities that are inherent within that. So thank you very much for your time, and I will see you somewhere in the world very soon.
It's been wonderful, Nicholas. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Cheers. Take care. Bye.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.